Welcome to the Recovering from Religion podcast. We are a vibrant international community for those who have questions or doubts about their faith. I'm your host, Tim Reimel, along with my co-host, Bill Prickett. Bill, I'm not sure if I ever shared this story on the show, but it's in my book. And
I want you to share a story because I'm being accused of sharing stories all the time. So I want you to share a story.
All right. Well, let's see if they edit mine out. A few years ago, Abel's father died. And Abel, for those of you who don't know, is my husband. His father died, and Abel is from a very traditional Mexican family, and they live in Southern California. We went to the wedding, and his mother unilaterally and inexplicably decided that she was going to have a Catholic funeral. Now, I know that's not uncommon for Mexican families, but this family was not necessarily religious. And in fact, he thought his dad kind of fell along the lines of somewhere being agnostic or atheist. He didn't really know. They didn't go to church. His mom practiced some strain of Catholicism and, I don't know, voodoo or something. I don't know what the thing was, but it was odd. And if anything, they would more identify as evangelical Christians, because when Abel got older and one of his siblings got older, they attended an evangelical church. So that was more of the culture that they had become familiar with. So out of the blue, it's, I think, just a few days before the funeral, she decides to turn this into a Catholic funeral. And so we all go down. We have the priest and the casket sitting out there. So this is a new experience for me. I'd never been to, I've never experienced a funeral in the Catholic Church. We're going through the service, and because he comes from a traditional Mexican family, I look behind us, and so all of these people are behind the front row where Abel and his family are sitting. And as the service is going on, they seem to know when to sit, they know when to stand, they know when to kneel, they know when to respond to the priest. And then here's Abel's family sitting in the front row, looking as confused as hell. They didn't know what was going on. They didn't know when to respond. It was like nobody gave them a bulletin. It was like they walked in off the street and had never seen anything like this before. And then at one point, they rang these bells. And since Abel didn't know what that represented, he said, all I could think of was me being a little kid walking into a liquor store with my dad. And so every time the bells went off, I would watch him smile. He would get the snicker on his face. So we're at this funeral. We get through it. And the funny thing was that Abel says that he said, we're in this Catholic church. And he goes, they tried to pass the priest off as Mexican, but he was Indian. And I saw it. But the funny thing was, right, is that the culture that his mom felt like she needed to be a part of at that moment in time was her Catholic upbringing, her religious upbringing. And it wasn't something that she was necessarily familiar with her personally, but it was something that permeated the family structure. And being a part of that experience really highlighted the fact that we grow up in cultures that we don't really think about what it means to us. It's just there. It's just a part of who we are. If you've grown up in America, where 70.6% of Americans identify as Christian, you have seen nativity scenes. You have seen Jesus on the cross during Easter. You've probably gone to church during Easter and Christmas because it is such a part of our culture and who we are. And we operate under those beliefs or assumptions in our culture, and that religion kind of by osmosis becomes our religion, and we just don't think about it.
Well, I saw that when I was a pastor. I would have people come to me, couples would come to me, and they would want to get married in the church. And as I would question them about their church or their church background, I would have occasions where neither one of them had ever been in church, they didn't go to church, but they felt they needed a religious wedding.
Right.
And the same in funeral situations where I've had funerals where the person who we're burying had never been in church, and the family wants you to say all of these wonderful, nice things so that they get a comfort somehow in knowing that there was a religious element to the funeral as well. So weddings and funerals are two things that I saw that people just have this kind of mentality that they needed some religious stamp on what they were doing.
Yeah, it was funny when they had the casket out. So the priest, and again, I don't really know what all this is, but the priest had this holy water, I guess, and he would shake it over the casket and he would walk mm-hmm. around. He would shake it over the casket again. So he did this about three times. And by the end of it, at this point, they're in the service. And Abel's thinking, good God, if he's not, you know, if he's not blessed and holy at this point, nothing's going to work. So stop it. But it just kept going and going and going. And it was, you know, from an outsider's perspective watching this, I'm like, what do you think this is going to accomplish? Do you mm-hmm. need that? You put holy water on them and then suddenly everything changes for them? Or it didn't make any sense, but I digress.
It's a different culture. I mean, but it is a religious culture and it yes. permeates his kind of background and his heritage. But it runs everywhere where I grew up in the Deep South, and it's everywhere there.
Yes.
Whether you go to church or not, there's just some things that people expect. I remember I was still in youth ministry, and I had a conversation with my father one time, and I had never seen him in church in my entire life. And I was studying something in college, and a passage of scripture came up, and I said what I believed about it, and he absolutely disagreed with me. And I was in college studying theology. He had never been to church, as far as I knew, ever, and he knew best. So, and it was what he had been taught or what he had kind of absorbed in culture.
Yeah, it runs deep. Religion
yes.
runs deep.
Yes.
In all of us. And we, you know, we vote with our religious beliefs, even though we don't realize that they're there. We think with these religious beliefs that we don't realize that are there. And it's a part of our lives. Certainly in America, it's a part of our lives.
Yes.
And it has a very deep impact on how we relate to the world around us.
Exactly.
So it's going to be interesting today talking to Devin Singh when we get into this interview, who has a book called Divine Currency. We want to welcome Devin Singh, and Devin is a social theorist and scholar of religion and theology. He is an assistant professor of religion at Dartmouth College. He received his PhD from Yale, where he was named a Whiting Fellow, Yale's highest recognition for research in humanities. Devin was also trained and earned a master's degree in social scientific theory and methods at the University of Chicago, a master's of divinity in theology and divinity at Trinity International University, and a bachelor's degree in religious studies at Pomona College. So, Devin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for the opportunity. I appreciate the invitation. It's great to be talking with you.
We really are glad you're here.
I appreciate it.
And there's a lot of ground to cover. So with all of those credentials, just a warning here that we are not quite as educated. And I know, Bill, sounds like you never went to school at all.
Hey. Just because I grew up in Alabama, where English is our second language, there's no reason to slam. I have had some education. I can put sentences together. And
yeah, oh, I've heard them. Yeah. So Devin, tell us about yourself.
Well, as you mentioned, I currently teach religion and social theory, broadly speaking, at Dartmouth College. And, you know, my focus is on the connections between religion, politics, and economics primarily. And so I focus mostly on Christianity. That's kind of my area of expertise. And its long history of complicated interaction with the economic realm, with money and exchange and ideas of value, and also with politics and with notions of authority, power, and legitimacy, and how all those things are interlinked. And certainly we can talk about how money and markets are connected to states and state power, and how they're connected to churches and other organizations. And so I'm interested in researching those things and exposing some of the sources of where that power and influence comes from in our present.
And where did you grow up?
I grew up kind of all over the place. So I was born in California, in Sacramento. And my mother joined the Foreign Service very soon after that. So my dad is from India. My mother is Anglo-American, born and raised in the States. And she joined the State Department, the Agency for International Development, to do development work in so-called third world countries. So when I was three, we moved to Cameroon in West Africa and lived there for 4 years, and then on to Morocco and lived there for 3 years. So from age 3 to 10, seven years of my childhood were spent in Africa in these international development contexts. My parents separated pretty soon after the move there. My dad came back to the States and was remarried, but I lived with my mom there and spent a big part of my childhood in that context, and came back to the U.S. at age 10 and have been in California, Chicago, D.C., all over the place, and have since also spent time living in Germany as well as in Thailand and India. So have continued that nomadic lifestyle, and it's a blessing and a curse. It's many things that I appreciate about it, and obviously there are cost to that as well, but a lot of movement and a lot of exposure to different cultures.
And your religious background is pretty diverse, right?
It is. So as I mentioned, my father's from India. He comes from the Punjab area in the north, and his family is Sikh. He himself is not a practicing Sikh, although he still identifies strongly in terms of its sort of cultural identity and its tenets. My mother's family is sort of loosely, nominally Episcopalian. But my mother had a conversion experience, a born-again conversion experience when I was in junior high. And she became involved with evangelical, sort of somewhat charismatic Christianity for a good portion of her life. And so that exposed me to those traditions and prompted some of my own quest and investigations of some of these things. So it's yeah, certainly a mix. And obviously living in various countries, I was exposed to various other religious traditions, obviously Islam in Morocco. And so have had to, I joke that I've kind of been forced to think a lot about religion and culture and identity throughout my life.
Yeah. That's interesting about your mom, because from my own studies, the modern charismatic movement began with Episcopalians.
That's interesting. I am aware. I'm certainly aware of some of the charismatic arm of the Anglican and Episcopalian, and mm-hmm. sort of what are considered more traditional mainline churches.
Yeah,
I mean, we can tie it back to Pentecostalism at the beginning of the early 20th century, certainly, and others. So, I think there's certainly a variety of sources, I think, to the contemporary charismatic movement. She did, interestingly enough, her conversion experience was at an Episcopal church. We were living in D.C. at the time, and it was a pretty remarkable experience. So she became gravely ill. Nobody could really diagnose what it was, but she was essentially sort of wasting away. And as she narrates it later, she heard a voice saying, "You're sick because of your sin, and you need to come get to know me." And she was like, "What is this? You know, this God that I don't believe in is apparently speaking to me." And so she didn't really know where to go, but you know, you're living in DC, there's one place that everyone knows. It's a national cathedral. You can see it anywhere in the city. It's the giant church, basically, St. Albans, and it's an Episcopal church. So she made her way there and got in touch with a pastor and was sort of, shepherded into the fold, as it were.
So what's your emotional connection to religion?
That's an interesting question. I mean, wow. I guess my first explorations and exposures to it as an angst-filled, angry, rebellious teenager and delinquent were sort of, you know, a quest for a sense of peace, a quest for a sense of meaning, frustration at the hypocrisy that I saw in authority figures, in forms of religion. And, you know, I experienced a good sense of peace, belonging, finding my identity, forms of healing in religious community. And I've also sort of gone through my own experiences of disillusionment and critical distance from a lot of that as well. So it's I guess, a mixed bag of emotions in terms of my relationship to religion.
So what prompted your interest in studying? I mean, clearly you've studied religions. What drives you? I know when people get a PhD, they always say, you make sure that you love what you're doing, because you're going to be, you know, under it for a long time as you're studying.
I think part of it was exploring and trying to make sense of this very diverse hodgepodge of experiences that I had with religion, but also with questions of culture and identity. I went into undergrad sort of in a kind of default position of, well, I'm going to study medicine, be pre-med, be a bio major, go on and do that. And I loved biology. I can't say I was a fan of organic chemistry. That was one of those disillusioned moments and prompted me to sort of rethink my major and my direction and what I actually was in love with and passionate about. And at that point, it was these big questions of meaning and significance in life. And I've always sort of been a kind of big picture, big idea person. And I love these types of questions in terms of why are we here? What is this about? And also questions about social and economic justice, you know, having thought about poverty and questions like that, being exposed to that, I wanted to explore that from a philosophical and religious point of view. So my tie into studying religion was always linked with questions about politics, questions about economic exploitation and injustice, and questions of poverty. And what appeared to me was this sort of revolutionary potential in religion, particularly in some of the sayings of Jesus and some of these early movements that I found very appealing.
In my own studies, when I wrote my last book, I really got into the politics and religion aspect of this. And quite honestly, and maybe to my own embarrassment, I really didn't understand how tied together they were growing up in the evangelical church as I did. And as Bill mentioned earlier, you know, in our, before we started recording, is that there are so many things that they don't tell you when you go to seminary. And one of those was that the evangelical faith has just always been that way. It was at the time of Christ, and 2,000 years later, here we are. So when I began to study where religion came from and how from the earliest stages, as far back as we can go, we see that there is a political and religious tie. There, either the religious leader was working with the political leader, or they were one and the same.
Yes, one of the most remarkable things about evangelicalism is the way in which it narrates a story about itself as being very apolitical, very non-political. It's about the spiritual. It's about your personal relationship with Jesus. And yet it's one of the most highly politicized religious movements in our contemporary scene. It has roots, very, very sort of recent roots in the 1970s and the connection with the rise of the religious right. And it's tied to questions of voting and voting blocks and lobbying and power. And yet it tells the story about, you know, this is a simple message of the gospel. It's been the case for 2,000 years. And when you actually study it, it's the church and what Christians have thought and believed is quite a mixed, diverse bag and have believed many things across the centuries.
Right. In an interview with Ilana De Castro of Fausto magazine, she asked you a question, which was, to understand international politics, is it essential to understand religion? And your response was certainly that religion is a highly determinant aspect of culture and a force that shaped nations and communities. The lack of attention to religion and the naivety surrounding it lead to many blind spots in international relations and politics. Although it is obvious in today's world due to the conflicts in which religion is explicitly invoked, we need to pay attention to how religion still operates on the surface of supposedly secular political struggles. Can you explain that a little bit, unpack it a little bit?
Absolutely. So we can certainly point to forms of religious extremism today as one example of the importance of understanding religion in terms of international relations and politics. But what I was getting at with that is that even when it's not so obvious and overt, that our systems of government, our notions of power, authority, and legitimacy have been steeped for centuries in assumptions about how God rules the world, how God relates to humanity, how God shares or doesn't share power. These are reflections that political theorists have drawn on from theologians and philosophers throughout the course of history, at least in thinking about the West and Europe as it's been shaped and steeped in its interactions with the church and theology. So we can dig into notions of power and authority that people believe they see in the Bible and how those then shaped notions of how pastors and ministers should rule over their flock, and then how that then informed kings and emperors who thought that they were trying to emulate God in terms of how they ruled. And then even in this transition to the sort of a supposedly secular modern world, those assumptions are still there operating, even if they're not given, people don't give credence to the religious roots or undergirding logic to them. So that's the claim. It's still at play, and we need to understand. And as you read and study the history of religion and theology, you start to see how these things are at work still in the present.
Do religion and politics always intercept?
I'm sure we can find plenty of exceptions where we want to say these are discrete aspects or discrete spheres where they don't, but I think by and large they do. And I think in the most of the history of human civilization, they've been strongly overlapping. And it's really only in the last 300, 400 years that people have been trying to sort of tease them apart and think about them as separate things. And it, again, it's debatable to whether, to what extent they actually are separate. But we certainly try to think about them in separate ways. And I think, you know, a case can be made for some aspects.
And to your point, you know, the what I've noticed too is that we don't realize how much our own culture influences us in our religion and politics. It's we live in it. We're inundated by it. You know, I talk about when I left the faith, I was still a right-wing voting Republican because that's how I was raised, and I didn't realize how integrated my religion and politics had become. But we're surrounded by a culture of religious faith. You know, and it's always interesting when the religious right cries persecution, when you think that 70.6% of the United States still identify as Christians. They've taken over the Congress. You know, they have massive control over what's happening in the United States right now. And the influences for the rest of us, whether you believe it or not, is the influences are there. The influences are still guiding us and leading us and helping us make decisions that we are completely unaware of.
Absolutely. Yeah, there have been some interesting studies done where people have looked at people's religious beliefs, which influence how they think about power and authority. I mean, you know, your vision of God and how God acts and interacts will affect then how you think about how others, how leaders should be and how power should be distributed or shared or not shared. And so that lends itself directly to politics. And certainly there, you know, there's a important early saying among feminist thinkers and early women's rights thinkers that the personal is the political. And that, you know, I think that's a correct insight that people's personal concerns and desires become translated and projected onto political movements and systems. And you, it doesn't make sense to draw a strong, sharp dichotomy between those. All these desires and wishes that we have in our personal life might will definitely affect political action and policy.
Right.
I know from being raised in Alabama, even when it's not being discussed strictly as religion, the religious culture has so saturated just everyday life. People make decisions and it's based on gender norms, gender expectations, and it's just kind of what you do. But when you push people on it, it does go back to some kind of religious mentality.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't know about other, you know, like in California or upstate New York or whatever, but I know in the South, it was just, there were certain things that were expected. And whether it was race relations, because I grew up in Birmingham, Alabama in the 60s. And so in race relations, we saw it. There was a certain kind of expectation of, you know, what your place is, and they would tie it back to, you know, God's creation, God made us different, and things like that. So I saw that in and coming out later in life, people just expect a certain kind of behavior from everyone around them. So I guess my question to you is, Tim asked about, is politics and religion always connected? Do you think it was intention that way? Because when you read, when you, you know, kind of read the scriptures, there's a mixed bag of whether we should be involved or not involved or in the world, not of the world. Is that an expectation of, say, early theology, or is it an aberration that developed later?
Yeah, that's a great question. Certainly religion has, it's an aspect of culture. It's always been an aspect of culture, and it's tightly integrated with it. And it's only really recently that we've tried to, certain movements in religious movements have tried to think about religion and culture as somehow separate or distinct or opposed. You do find countercultural statements and trends in many religious traditions, and certainly parts of the early church and some of these early Jesus communities had ideals about trying to live distinctly from what they saw as the ideals of the Roman Empire. So there are moves toward distinction. There are moves toward distinctiveness. But it's not, when somebody thinks they're somehow being acultural or non-cultural in doing that, that's sort of a misrecognition. It might be, you know, an alternative set of cultural values, but you're creating culture when you're doing that. It's not in a vacuum, but it certainly can oppose itself to what people understand as some of the dominant cultural values of the time.
Right. And I think people today, because for the last 40 years, with the rise of the moral majority and those areas, those kind of movements, we haven't really seen the distinction as much. It's almost pushed within, especially in the evangelical conservative circles, it's pushed for an active level of involvement. So there is not even a semblance of let's be separate. It is pulling down the separation and fighting for a much more unity between politics and religion.
I think it's also strategic, though, and you'll see this, and you'll see evangelical leaders play with this to their advantage. So on one hand, when it's a debate about a certain kind of legislating morality, whether it's abortion or sort of heteronormative relations, it'll be that exactly, this integration that you've named, Bill. But then if somebody talks about, well, shouldn't our policy then include justice on behalf of the poor and economic concerns? And then they'll say, well, this is all going to burn anyhow. The Lord's going to, this all needs to be passed through the fire. And there is that strategic move to say, well, this doesn't matter. We don't need to be a part of this and of this world. We need to be, not of it. And so it becomes the strategy that you can disavow belonging when it suits you and then try to say, oh, we need to be here and seek the welfare of the city, and quoting, different prophetic voices to uphold a certain kind of moral vision.
There was a person on my one of my Facebook author page who, every time I would say something, she would always bring up this issue of abortion. And at one point, I want to have a conversation initially, but at one point I said, you keep talking about abortion, but you're not talking about what happens after the baby is born and what happens if that child is gay or now the mother is poor and you're trying to cut off any kind of assistance to them. And her response was, well, that's not my ministry.
There you go. Exactly. Yeah. So like, again, the strategic kind of separation based on these sort of one ticket political items.
Right. And Bill, I know being in the, well, for you being in the South and me being in godless California, it's interesting to watch the history from here because it goes back so far. We like to think that we've moved on beyond this race issue, and yet it permeates the South to this day. And if you call them on white privilege, they don't get it. They don't see it. They don't understand it. And it's so tied into religion and Christianity and the upbringing that you and I went through that it's astonishing.
Yeah, and we've seen recently some instances of overt racism within some of the marches that have gone on in Birmingham, and several high schools have had some problems. And I see it, and I remember being in high school during the 60s, during the first wave of forced desegregation, busing in students. And I thought we had come farther than that, but we haven't. And so I see that. And I remember hearing it at growing up. And so as I listened to Devin talking about this kind of mindset, it brings back that to me. And I appreciate that he ties it back to a concept of economy, and even he uses the term accounting. I watched a video that he did, a lecture that he did in the Netherlands, and talks about the gospel language of accounting. And I was fascinated because obviously that was not taught to us in seminary. We talked about money in the church that I grew up in, but it was only in the sense of giving and tithing and being good stewards, and debt was not a good thing, but not this idea of economy. And so, Devin, what got you interested in that dimension of theology? Because I haven't read anything else by anybody else on this.
Yeah, it's a small but developing conversation. I mean, there's a lot of scholarly work on theology and economics, religion and economics. It is an established field, but it does tend to take the typical perspective of, well, here are some biblical or theological principles, or maybe even some philosophical principles that we can use to think about economics and sort of the morality and ethics of economics. What I wanted to do was show the interconnection between religion and economics, and to not let folks off the hook to think that they can keep those as neatly divided spheres or sets of practices. And in terms of the practices that you named, Bill, in terms of kind of personal stewardship and whatnot, that's also tied to our political moment that really focuses on the individual and individual morality, but doesn't want to turn its eye toward the larger questions of systems and structures that are in place and cultures that are in place that reproduce assumptions about money and value. And that's part of also what I shed light on looking at early Christian empire and actual administration and structures and not just kind of personal morality.
Yeah, and I've seen that having worked in now for the last 20 years in social settings. I have people regularly tell me, well, we don't want the government to do this, let the church do it. And so that, but they say that on such a surface level that you were talking about earlier, but the church then is also free to reject whomever they don't want to help. If somebody is openly gay, we don't want to give them food from our pantry. If somebody is transgender, we don't want to let them stay in our overnight shelter. So there is this, give your money, be a good steward, tithe, but we're not going to help just everybody.
Yeah, the ironic thing is some of these early moves toward social welfare and state intervention were led by Christians and churches who recognize those very biases and recognize that our individual sort of prejudices and sensibilities may get in the way. Also that society on a whole has a responsibility to care for the least of these. And so it shouldn't be left up to willy-nilly, you know, churches here and there, but there should be an actual system and structure in place. And so these are driven early on by Christian views of caring for the common good. And so states and policies should be instituted to carry out some of those tasks.
Last year, you released your book, Divine Currency. And I don't think I mentioned that in the intro here, but talk about divine currency. Can you kind of explain what that concept is?
So that term is a broad term to talk about a variety of different things. One is how God was described essentially as an economist of sorts, as somebody who manages and administers the goods of creation, the resources of creation, as a God who oversees the processes of redemption. And sometimes, you know, you will hear theologians talk about the redemptive economy or the economy of salvation. But what that means is there's this logical process that God oversees. And often God is described as a money manager or as a steward that is superintending these processes. Within that, Christ is often conceived of as a kind of currency, as the one that's used to purchase redemption for humanity. And we still use this language today of somebody being bought with the blood or bought back from, purchased from sin, etc. And these are early narratives and stories in the church of humanity being somehow in debt slavery to the devil or to sin or to death. And Christ is the price, the purchase fee used to free humanity. And this language persists, and I argue that that informs a lot of how we think about how money and value are to be used. It also projects economic ideas onto this eternal cosmic plane. I mean, if God is doing these things, then how much more should we be trying to use economy in savvy and productive ways as well? And so it justifies a lot of economic practices, again, because God is doing that. So divine currency is a term that I use to sort of signal these various economic themes that are at work in early Christian theology and that persist. And certainly they're transformed and they're perhaps under the surface now, but I think are still there and inform Christian assumptions about money, economics, and exchange.
So can you expand on that a little bit? Because I know in your lecture on greed and God, as well as your book, you describe God as economic administrator and Christ as God's currency. Can you break that down a little bit more?
So in so-called Orthodox, sort of typical mainstream Christian thought, it's Trinitarian and God the Father is seen as the Trinity is overseeing all these aspects of creating the world and saving humanity. The Son, God the Son, is the one who takes on human flesh and becomes the person of Christ and dies and is resurrected and draws humanity back to God. So in that story, I'm saying that we find plenty of examples where that story is told economically, where God the Father sending the Son can be likened to a emperor who coins coins and sends those coins with the imperial image out into their community. And just as the Son is the image of the Father and reflects back the truth of God, coins bear this image of the emperor and circulate in this community and create relationships of subservience to this emperor. So there are examples of this where God is likened to this kind of either ruling emperor or a savvy money manager who uses this currency to gain a certain kind of profit. In this case, the profit is redemption, is salvation.
I know when you talked about the idea of ransom, that was one of the areas that connected with me, because as a pastor, even years ago in my very conservative days, I don't know if people realize this, but there are some things that your pastor may not share with you that they have doubts about. They're not going to come out and say, you know, I know our church teaches this, but I have real serious considerations. And I've shared in the past that one of those for me was the concept of hell. It just never resonated with me. So in the 12 years that I pastored a Southern Baptist, 11 years that I pastored a Southern Baptist church, I never preached on hell, because I just couldn't wrap my head around it. But I do remember that the idea of ransom connected with me as a pastor. That I understood. I never, one of the elements that I couldn't get was Jesus as a substitutionary sacrifice. That just struck me as so bizarre, that God was so vengeful that he had to send Jesus and then kill him on our behalf. So I never could get that one. But the idea of ransom, that Jesus was paying a ransom, I did understand that one. And so the famous words of Jesus on the cross when he said, "It is finished," the Greek word there, tetelestai, which means it's paid for. I did understand that. So when you were talking about that, that really did mean something to me. I don't know that I can embrace that now in my place of faith, but I did understand that even back then.
It is a powerful metaphor. There's a powerful set of metaphors. And part of why they're powerful is that we are immersed in economic language and terms. And so we do get them. And we see this part of the early Christian imagination is drawing on developments in Judaism that use language of sin as a kind of debt before God. And we find this in parts of the Hebrew scriptures that whereas sin was earlier talked about as a sin, as a stain or a weight, later iterations of the scriptures, later writings talk about it as a debt that needs to be paid. And we understand that. People get that. And so being immersed in this economic language, we can understand this idea of humanity needing to be ransomed or paid for, or bought back in some way. And there's lots of then emotional attachment that gets attributed to that. And I can think of, I'm sure there's some hymns and praise choruses that will celebrate that and talk about being ransomed and redeemed, right? And being purchased and bought back. And the kind of then attachments of love and emotion that get mixed in with that in terms of what's perceived as the grace of God.
Well, and I do think that writers in that day and throughout what we know as scripture, they used images and analogies that resonated with the people then. And so the idea of ransom was so prevalent in that day. And so it made a valid metaphor for what they were trying to say.
Well, didn't we see this throughout history, right? If you go back before Christianity, you see the same thing. I mean, you see this in Greek mythology where somebody had to, get on a boat and go across the hell, what we call hell today, and get someone back. So it's not unique to Christianity, but why do we think in those terms? And is this purely an economic term? Is this a spiritual term? How do they interact with each other?
That's true. Plenty of religious traditions and mythologies have transactional language. And this is a very common thing that we see early on in human civilization, this notion that one needs to transact in some way with the invisible or spiritual realm, whether it's to offer a sacrifice to appease, whether it's to offer the first fruits of one's labor in some way to either pay for blessing or to appease the wrath of a deity. So there's transactional language, and the Roman Empire talks about it as well, this kind of tit for tat language that one offers to the gods. And that's sort of a much deeper question of where this comes from in the human psyche and in human civilization. But it's pretty broad based in various cultures and civilizations. Obviously, it takes different forms. Anthropologists talk about communities that develop forms of gift exchange that look very different than the kind of money that emerges in certain parts of the world. And it's language, it's metaphor, so it blurs together with how we speak about the spiritual realm and think about the spiritual realm, and how we do economics. So I think economics and religion are also very blurred together for most of it, their history. And also in the last few hundred years, we try to tease them out and separate those out as separate ideas and concepts. So to your question, yeah, they're both. It's both. This economic language is both spiritual and economic.
And you mentioned hymns we sing. I mean, the very term, I know my Redeemer lives, the very term Redeemer has an economic aspect to it.
Absolutely. Yeah. So that language in the Hebrew scriptures comes from this notion of the kinsman redeemer, that if you're in slavery in some way, often it's due to a debt that's been imposed on you, but perhaps you've been captured, that somebody can come and purchase you back. And so there's a long history of that notion. And it's understandably a very emotionally laden metaphor. I mean, this idea that you're captive and somebody who cares for you and loves you is going to come and buy you back. I mean, it's a powerful metaphor. Yes. And so that can then get transcribed onto God, and God does that for all of humanity. So there is a continuity of that metaphor, absolutely.
Yeah, and you've brought up so many questions to my mind. We're going to stop and take a break, and we'll be back in about a minute.
Recovering from Religion is funded by those who believe in what we do. We invite you to support us with a monthly or one-time donation. Go to our website, recoveringfromreligion.org, and click on the donate button for instructions. On the website, you'll also find an extensive database of resources, including links, articles, and videos. We offer 24-hour phone and chat line support, along with the links to meetup groups in 20 communities around the U.S. With our secular therapy project, we can connect you with a professional who offers evidence-based, non-religious treatment. Our partner therapists understand the complexities of rethinking or leaving your faith. Finally, Recovering from Religion is an entirely volunteer-run organization. If you're interested in being a volunteer with us, please visit recoveringfromreligion.org and look for the volunteer tab.
Many of us at Recovering from Religion know that changes to our faith and beliefs about God create uncertainty and anxiety. We can find ourselves lacking guidance and without a community. With that in mind, we've developed our first ever Recovering from Religion fall excursion, September 20th through the 22nd of this year. We'll be gathering in the tranquil mountains of North Carolina, where the stars are bright and the air is clean and fresh, and they talk with an accent like mine. Join us for workshops on embracing healthy sexuality, leaving fears of hell behind, yoga, a guided hike from our very own Dr. Daryl Ray, stargazing, wine and cider tasting, campfires, music, great food, and of course, great company. The on-site lodges are comfortable and modern, and our registration includes all meals and activities. Tickets and lodging are limited, so register early at recoveringfromreligion.org. Free from judgment, join us and rediscover yourself. Devin, you used a phrase earlier, and as soon as you said it, I've been jotting down things over here. You used the term, the idea of pay for blessing. Can you talk more about that? Because as I was reading your materials and listening to your lecture in the Netherlands, the idea of theology and economics just came together for me in this idea that you didn't use this term, but we kind of see God as this divine heavenly vending machine.
That is a common image. And a lot of religious traditions, I think, have aspects where it seems like, or where it might be this kind of transaction where you pay in some way, whether it's actually paying a religious organization or an official in order to get blessing, or whether it's paying in some other way through personal sacrifice, through a certain kind of suffering and devotion. It can take a variety of forms. And of course, different parts of Christianity, most notably different Protestant movements, will sort of try to distinguish themselves and say, well, what sets us apart from all these is that we don't believe that. And we believe that God is purely gracious and you can never sort of pay to earn blessing. This is part of the Reformers' critique of at least some versions of Catholicism back in the day. But, you know, we can find examples of how those movements then created their own ways where one needed to live a life of devotion in order to earn favor. One needed to demonstrate a certain kind of life of holiness to earn divine favor. So it's really hard to escape that transactional kind of paying for blessing mindset, regardless of the tradition. Again, even in these traditions that said they were against all that, it creeps up in various ways. And we certainly see that in the contemporary evangelical church, whether it is actually quite literally with paying for blessings and the prosperity and kind of health and wealth movements, or in other forms of devotion where you need to earn a blessing in some way.
The interesting thing is when you read the teachings of Jesus, who talked about money a lot, and he talked about the poor and the widows and the orphans and the Apostle Paul as well. How did we get from some of those simple teachings, and even the early church in the early writings of the early church and like the book of Acts, they saw this kind of communal idea of everybody sharing what they had with one another. How did it move to what you talk about as not as a currency, but it became this source of God's blessing and approval?
It's a really interesting and convoluted journey. The early church on the whole was radically, some would say, socialist. I mean, it was communal property and radical sharing. A lot of teaching on almsgiving and living simply and giving away one's belongings and sharing those with the community or giving them to the poor. Part of it was a pragmatic need that there were rich or wealthy patrons that were supporting some of these house churches, and it wasn't feasible to tell them to sort of give away all their property, and then they could no longer support these churches and communities. And so we see some sort of softening of that language of radical divestment of your money and resources. And so the rich can now kind of give in a more incremental way to the community to sustain it. So we see that. But also, it's interesting how there's sort of selective memory loss and selective sampling from scripture, where you'll often hear preaching of not those verses of caring for the least of these and giving away your money and belongings in order to follow Christ, but you'll find language of, well, if, and people can draw from the book of Proverbs and other scriptures where it does say that, you know, if you obey God, that you will be blessed, and that, you know, wealth or a certain kind of security can be a sign that, you know, you're living a righteous life. So somebody can take that out of context or just take that and apply it to a whole sort of philosophy and vision of life, that if you're right with God, then you should be right financially. And that's kind of how it gets played out in a lot of contemporary conversation, that there's this other language of blessing and prosperity that work against these other notions of the call to poverty and simplicity.
Yeah, as with other things, there is this ability to selectively pick the verses that we like. When I was a pastor, I struggled with, and I spoke at churches and conferences all over the country, and I would regularly confront the prosperity mindset and the verses that they would use, as opposed to the ones that, I mean, we could get into a battle of the Bible verses. And so there is this kind of prevailing mentality that our wealth and our money is a sign of God's blessing.
Yeah, and that's partly why I think the kind of Bible-only mentality is problematic. On one hand, for one thing, it's not really realistic, even for folks who claim to be living only based on the scriptures. I mean, it's not really something one can do. There are all sorts of other filters and things that come in from culture and background and upbringing that are shaping one's assumptions. And they also affect how one reads and interprets scripture. And this is why you can have people who both claim that the Bible is the word of God and to want to obey it fully to disagree about interpretations. So these kinds of Bible-only mentalities are kind of disingenuous. And one can proof text and be selective and pick and choose and choose what they want to live by.
I had somebody, I had posted an article, I think it was about a year old, about Paula White, who's the advisor for Donald Trump. And she was asking donors to send her money for whatever reason, as if they, you know, they didn't, there'd be some horrendous thing that would happen to them. And a family member posted on my site that we don't think that way. We don't believe that way. She's apostate, or whatever word that they wanted to use for her. And my response was, it doesn't really matter whether you think that way or not, is that she is now associated with this faith, this religion, which was my faith. That's how I grew up. And from the inside perspective, I could differentiate the two things. From an outside perspective, it's all the same to me. And this is the representation that we see in fundamentalist evangelical Christianity.
Totally. I think it's a historically significant moment that Trump included Paula White and others from these movements as part of the kind of inauguration moment. So he gave a sort of public platform and recognition to them as a kind of legitimate part of American Christianity. And arguably they are, in the sense that there are so many thousands of followers in America of these congregations. So that puts the pressure on other churches that they can't really so quickly and easily disavow these and say, well, that's not us, or that's not true Christianity. These are heretics or apostates. But these are people that are representing the church in some way, and that the rest of the church needs to reckon with what they're saying, and not just simply to kind of dismiss them, but to say, wow, there are aspects of our religious traditions that they're drawing on and bringing sort of as kind of their main points. And that's part of what I try to do in my book, is to show that some of these movements, you know, they can actually have legitimate claim on some of the history of Christian thought, because there are parts of theology that one can say, wow, this does seem to sort of support a prosperity sort of ideal. So it's not as uncomfortable as it makes much of the church. They can't just so quickly and easily kind of wriggle out of it by denying or dismissing these folk.
Can you talk about capitalism and the Reformation movement? I know I saw this or read this as I was doing the research, and somebody had said something about capitalism was part of the Reformation. I know that capitalism is certainly part of the evangelical movement now, but what is the correlation?
So there have been some studies. The most well-known was by a German sociologist, Max Weber, who wrote the famous book, The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism. So he, but a number of others, have linked what they call this Protestant ethic or Protestant ethos, these certain mentality, mindset, and practices that Protestant groups cultivated, and the rise of capitalism, or at least capitalism taking off. Arguably, capitalism was already sort of well underway in parts of Italy before the Reformation. But it really seems to take off in the Netherlands and in England later on. And it's linked to Protestant ideas of the self-denial, but translating that denial into hard work and labor as a sign of your devotion to God. I mean, these are mentalities that increase at this time. Whereas arguably before in the Catholic Church, you know, one labored or devoted oneself to God if you were a clergy or a monk, and the lay people didn't necessarily have to do that. They would, you know, show up and be part of the mass and other rituals. The Protestants said that, well, now because of this priesthood of all believers, everybody is a monk, everybody is clergy, everybody's called to this. And the way you show your devotion to God is through faithful work, faithful toil. But then if you're doing that and you're making all this money, you certainly can't live this luxurious lifestyle, because that wouldn't be godly either. So what do? You have all this capital left over, you reinvest it in the business. And there's this sort of cycle of capital reinvestment and venture that we see take off at this time, with this idea that you reinvest your profits into your business venture and it grows. So those are some of the mentalities that are linked with churches in the Reformation and ideas and practices that seem to really get capitalism going. There are others I can speak to, but those are some of the ways that it gets linked.
I have a question that if this is something you do not want to talk about, please just tell me, and I'll just fall back on the fact that I'm from Alabama and don't know better. But as one who writes about the interconnection these days of politics and religion, I was listening to you talk about and honestly, the church father now has gone out of my brain, but who was so adoring of Constantine. And as I listened to you talk about that, it brought me back to what we're seeing today with modern evangelicals and their adoration of Trump and the capitalism and wealth of the GOP. And I don't want to get into partisan politics, but I did see such a parallel there.
Yeah, you're referring to Eusebius of Caesarea.
Eusebius, yeah. I couldn't think of the name, and I didn't want to just start doing a Google search while I was talking.
No, that's fine. There's a bunch of names there that all kind of flow together. Eusebius is a much maligned figure in the early church, at least later, because of his apparent fawning over Constantine. So Eusebius is a bishop who writes one of the first church histories of the church, but also writes this oration in praise of Constantine and the life of Constantine. So Constantine is kind of considered one of the first Roman emperor who converts to Christianity, and so ushers in the series of changes that will bring the Roman Empire into alignment with the Christian church. Eusebius sees this as an amazing watershed moment. This must be divine providence. This must be the hand of God. And so reflects on and writes about Constantine's devotion. And he kind of offers this stylized and kind of done up portrait of Constantine as devoted to God. And of course, there are historical debates about to what extent Constantine was actually pious, et cetera, et cetera. But what this means is that many people, because of our suspicion of the links between religion and politics, for somebody like this to be so gung-ho about it, he's understandably taken a lot of flack for it. But arguably, he's just one of many cases where we can find this close association, and it occurs throughout history. And so I think contemporary examples of that are totally right in terms of there are examples of political parties, people, movements, who are absolutely supportive of presidential leaders or political parties and see it as the hand of God, see it as God's hand working. I mean, we see that language all the time in contemporary politics of God blessing and moving these particular political leaders. Even when, and I can think of, you know, interviews with prominent religious leaders, evangelicals, who will say something like, you know, even if Trump is totally godless, that, you know, God is using him and this is therefore our man in the White House, et cetera, et cetera. And the kind of mental backflips that folks need to do to justify these kinds of things is pretty impressive.
Yeah, and one of the main advocates of that is actually one of the pastors here where I live in Dallas, Texas, and he's regularly just saying that. And I had a discussion on Facebook just this past week where I was told that, you know, God put Trump in office, and of course the passage in Romans was quoted to me that there is no authority except that is ordained by God. And so there was this whole thing. And then one of the leaders of one of the religious right groups is now sending out an email to all of their followers for people to pray against any kind of impeachment or conviction of Donald Trump, because Donald Trump is God's person in office. And so I see this, and they will admit, no, I don't particularly like some of the things that he does, but I do believe that God's put him in office, and so we should respect and support him. But I don't see that, again, in the selective aspect. I don't see that in other areas and in other presidents that we've seen in the past.
Yeah, it's totally selective. I mean, why weren't the same churches saying that about Obama, for instance, right? I mean,
exactly.
and other presidential leaders.
And I just want to ask this woman. I said, if there is no authority except from God, as she quoted in Romans, if there is no authority except from God, then if the authority that is Congress makes a decision to remove a president, isn't that also ordained by God, because that's also an authority? So it's circular logic, I know, but sometimes I just like messing with them.
Well, it's good to challenge those assumptions. And that's an example of a verse that's been used and abused throughout history. And of course,
oh, absolutely, course, scary, yeah, as hell when people quote that verse to me.
Yeah, and of course the confessing church in Germany under Nazi occupation, led by folks, yes, like Karl Barth and Dietrich Bonhoeffer, had a very important sort of interpretation of that, you know, when the leaders are not aligned with the purposes of God, in the case of obviously the Nazis, then the duty is to resist. I mean, the actual Christian duty is not to obey passively like sheep, but it's to obey God, which leads to actually divergence and resistance, yeah, from against that, those leaders.
And Bonhoeffer was definitive example of that in his life.
Absolutely. Yeah. And of course paid the ultimate price with his life. Right.
Yes.
Well, and you know what, this is all part of the same theology. It's if God answers your prayer, then that proves he's God. If God doesn't answer it the way you believe, then he's still God. I mean, God can't lose either way. You know, whether it's Obama or it's not, they just worry that when it's Obama or another Democratic president, that is the devil.
Right.
When it's a Donald Trump, it's God working in mysterious ways. That's just typical in theology.
Yep, absolutely. Absolutely. It's kind of this way to justify various things and to then reinterpret them. And part of it is this larger quest for meaning making that we all struggle with as humans,
right,
and trying to make sense of things. And this is one framework that that has lots of problems, but it's a very appealing framework and strategy to justify events and people in authority to make sense of those things.
With all this talk about the economy and God's currency or divine currency, what's the takeaway for the average person?
Certainly to be aware and more self-aware of the kinds of metaphors and language that we use when speaking about. So in the case of people who are believers or attend churches and you know, maybe listening to sermons and thinking about theology and thinking about their own personal ideas about redemption and salvation. It's challenge and question those kinds of metaphors. And I'm not necessarily saying to do away with them, and I'm not even sure that's possible, but certainly to be self-aware of them and aware of the kinds of impact that it might be having on how one thinks about authority, economics, power, and greater self-awareness about then what one is doing with one's money and resources, how one is spending it, the kinds of implications of that as well. Trying to find ways, I would argue certainly try to find ways to use one's resources in ways that are life-giving and just and compassionate.
Religious nuns, agnostics, atheists, all those have the potential to be a larger voting bloc than the religious right and could turn the capitalist ideology around. Is this something you see happening, or do you think this Christian economy is too entrenched in American culture?
It's very entrenched, but it is malleable. And, even as we've been talking, we've come up with various different viewpoints and positions, and one can, again, be strategic about this. And there certainly are movements of progressive evangelicals, progressives who are non-religious, who can come up with compelling visions of economics. I think the challenge is the imagination of the public and the populace, and to find ways to tell a compelling story. And part of that might be using religion and the language of religion, but it might be finding other ways to do that as well, to transform people's imaginations of what is possible and what might be possible. I think we see a lot of narrowing of the imagination right now, and these kind of knee-jerk responses and assumptions about, well, this is socialism. This therefore means that the Soviets are back and they're going to take us over and it's all going to be downhill from there, or whatever sort of cascade of thoughts people right. might have, which are just sort of a little bit extreme. And so to think about transformations in the market and in economic relations in ways that can be more just and life-giving.
Before we close, I had one question that I wanted to ask you. I know that you have said on your website and your books and in the lecture that I saw that your focus is, number one, primarily about Christianity, but also Western Christianity. When thinking about things like the prosperity gospel and this kind of divine currency, is it different in, say, Eastern cultures?
There are links, and I assume by Eastern you're including sort of the non-West, which could be parts of the Global South and Africa and Asia and Latin America too.
Because I've always said that the prosperity gospel works in Western culture. Prosperity gospel to me works mostly for the pastors who are preaching it, but I think would you take the prosperity gospel to villages in South Africa or to some of the Middle Eastern cultures, it's just not a viable message there.
What's interesting about this, though, is that prosperity churches are most popular among the poor and lower income folk. So whether it's in the U.S., you don't find prosperity teaching, around sort of wealthy churches in Greenwich or Wall Street areas. You find them among the rural poor in the U.S., Mm-hmm. When you look at Africa, Asia, Latin America, these mega churches with tens of thousands of congregants, often they are among the poor and lower income. So there's a tremendous appeal in terms of the promises. Certainly, it doesn't work in terms of getting people out of poverty, but it certainly is a tremendous appeal. So there's something really perhaps disturbing, but worth exploring there about that appeal to these folks from these poor backgrounds. Mm-hmm. I will also say, though, that genealogically, we can trace most of these churches in these parts of the world to American and perhaps other European missionaries who founded these movements. And also the link between American Pentecostalism and prosperity movements and the kind of global satellite TV network is actually pretty profound. They're very media savvy. And so they're projecting these services that might be taking place in Texas. They're projecting them around the world simultaneously. And so folks in Africa and Latin America and Asia might actually be attending these church services virtually. So there's a lot of savvy marketing that's happening there. But there are links. And so certainly there are indigenous churches that have grown up in these areas that may seem to also be prosperity oriented, but a lot of them are linked to ideologies of the American dream and kind of this bootstrap mentality while using God as the way to do it. And you can link them back to American Christianity.
Well, it is the message of, in a sense, hope. I mean, if you do this, then eventually you won't live in such poverty. God will bless you and you will be prosperous.
Yeah, absolutely. It's certainly a message of hope. It's a holding out a promise. And the idea that you know, God doesn't want you to be poor. You shouldn't have to be poor and suffer. Of course, these are not going to be talking about the social, political, economic structures that might be causing this poverty.
No, that's...
They're going to put it on individual responsibility. It's your lack of faith. It's your own lack of faith. It's some moral failing on your part. You just need to give more, believe more. But certainly it's not about you getting organized with your fellow folks and going and talking about getting better wages or better government policy to help you develop economically. But it's about this personal sort of responsibility that arguably is not really having any change or having any effect on people. But yes, it's absolutely a persuasive message of hope and appealing to people's understandable suffering and sense of disillusionment with their situation. And holding out that promise that here are these simple steps that you can take, and they're very achievable. You know, give this amount and get these kinds of blessings in return.
And it's interesting you bring this up in your book too about colonizing, where you see, you know, God can be seen as annexing and colonizing satanic territory, and then you see the Europeans who are going out and doing the same thing. You draw an interesting analogy there. So do you kind of see the same thing happening? I mean, whether it's the prosperity gospel or not, you still see this colonization based on, at least loosely, where God takes over Satan's territory.
Yeah, historians have often reflected on and wondered why this colonization movement was so closely tied with missionary movement. And we find missionaries going out together with colonial administrators, sometimes they're the same person, who are bringing the gospel to, you know, so-called backwards people, and also bringing in these government structures that are going to enslave and extract their resources. And so, you know, what people have often wondered, you know, why are these things happening together, particularly when it seems like this missionary preaching and teaching should be about compassion, care, and concern, and not enslaving and colonizing them. And one of the sources I point to is this kind of theology where God is depicted as using economic means, using Christ as this currency to topple Satan, to buy back humanity, and also basically subjugate the devil. So there's this territory of darkness where the devil reigns, and God invades it essentially with economic tactics and brings that all into submission to God. And of course, that's told as a tale of triumph and grace and blessing. But when you translate that into Christian countries who see themselves as Christian going out and encountering non-Christian nations, there can be a dark side to that when they view themselves as benefiting these countries by colonizing them, bringing them into submission and subservience to this colonizing center, extracting resources, enforcing religious belief. I mean, there's a very troubling legacy to those ideas.
Well, our very country is in existence because of the concept of divine manifest. And manifest destiny, so that, you know, God had called us to take over this entire country, and regardless of the people that were hurt by it or whatever we did, it was God taking over this country.
Oh, completely. Yeah, this idea of manifest destiny and the city on a hill and all these narratives were then fitted in complementary ways with chattel slavery and bringing enslaved Africans over. And of course, with the conquest and genocide of native peoples. I mean, it's all tied together. And these aren't just sort of side collateral damage, but it was all linked together in this idea of claiming this land for God and claiming the blessing. And we find sermons from those times using the language of the Canaanite, the conquest of Canaan, and the Israelites decimating the inhabitants of the historical Palestine. So there's scripture that was used to justify that as well. And so it's certainly disingenuous to argue that religion didn't play a part in that. It was a very, very central part of colonizing the New World. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, there's so many issues and so many subjects that I wish we had time to get to, but I want you to tell people where they can find you and also where they can find your book.
So my website is just www.devinsingh.com, and my book is available on Amazon as well as on the publishing page from Stanford University Press. And again, the title is Divine Currency, The Theological Power of Money in the West.
And we will have a link to both Devin's website and the Amazon site for the book for those of you who are interested in it. Devin, we want to thank you so much for being here with us.
Thank you so much. This has been a wonderful conversation. I appreciate the invitation and opportunity.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Recovering from Religion podcast. If you have questions for either of us or suggestions for future topics, you can email us at podcast@recoveringfromreligion.org. If you think you'd like to be one of our guests, we have a form on the podcast page of the Recovering from Religion website. We'd love to hear from you.